Hello and welcome to another episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today, I was incredibly excited to have with me Ali Madhavji. Ali is the managing partner at Blockchain Founders Fund, a pioneering early stage VC firm based in Singapore and the first regulated Web3 fund in the region. Ali's background spans tech entrepreneurship, venture investing and consultancy on emerging technologies for global impact, including advisory roles with INSEAD and the United Nations. Previously with PwC across North America, Brazil, and the Caribbean, Ali is deeply experienced in navigating complex global markets. Passionate about education and social development, Ali is an international award-winning author of multiple books aimed at empowering youth and students worldwide. In today's episode, we talk about unraveling Web3 hype and whether we've recovered from consumer skepticism.
You know, we've definitely had a lot of people sort of enter this space that, you know, maybe weren't building it for the right reason.
How to build systems to on-ramp consumers without them even knowing it. How can 100 million people learn about Web3?
The big thing here is, how do we help, you know, millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people learn about Web3 and actually decipher what's going on in a, you know, an easy, fun way?
Crypto nights on Amazon Prime might just be the answer. What happens when citizens don't trust their central currencies, and CBDCs and the velocity of money.
Essentially, every country in the world will pretty much launch a CBDC.
How regulation has actually helped allow blockchain startup builders to build, and why capital is global, but talent at early stage may need to be local. Can the right sentiment drive the right policies?
You didn't have the right policies from a regulatory perspective to just get out of the way and let them operate and build something that's incredible for the world.
And Ali's 90-step process to help founders get fundraise ready. Why you should have 11, 30, and 90-second pitches ready.
We tell our founders to have 11, 30, and 90-second pitches.
Let's get straight into it. Hey guys, whilst I've got you for a second, I thought I'd reintroduce myself. My name's Arish, I'm the host of Nothing Ventured, the podcast where I talk to the people behind the stories that make the venture ecosystem go round. I'm also the founder of Emerge One, a consultancy that provides fractional CFO support to venture-backed tech startups from seed to Series B and beyond. If you enjoy the podcast, we'd love it if you could rate, like, subscribe, and share because it really helps improve our reach. But of course, if you want to talk to us about anything to do with the podcast or even suggest a new guest, do reach out to me on LinkedIn or Twitter. I'm always keen to hear from fans. Thank you for listening. Let's get straight back into it. Ali, great to have you here with me today. Really looking forward to this conversation. We've had a few kind of VCs on talking about crypto, Web3, blockchain. It's an area where I have to admit I'm not necessarily an expert by any stretch of the imagination, but it is something I am super interested in seeing kind of the trajectory from where it was to where it's going. So thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure.
So we're going to kind of dive straight in. So, you know, thinking about blockchain and especially beyond the kind of hype and thinking about real world use cases, you know, we've seen blockchain and crypto go from hype to skepticism back again. Now in terms, you know, we're looking in terms of practical, impactful use cases. So where are we with that? And how do you identify blockchain startups that genuinely leverage the technology for competitive advantage rather than just the trend? I mean, the question that, you know, a lot of technologists that I know who are maybe sort of slightly Web3 skeptical will say, well, why did this need to be built on Web3? Why couldn't it have been built on sort of traditional Web2 rails? So yeah, we'd love to get your kind of take on all of that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, we've definitely had a lot of people sort of enter this space that, you know, maybe weren't building it for the right reasons. I think you've also had oftentimes the public not really know, you know, what is really blockchain, what is not, right? And I think when you look at the transformational impact of this technology, it's so tremendous. And you look at sort of how far, you know, things like Bitcoin have come, you look at how far things like Ethereum and decentralized finance have come to really be able to start to create foundational systems that allow you to leapfrog even some of the existing, you know, financial infrastructure is so impressive. But there are challenges, right? So if you take a few years ago, I think we had a lot of hype, and then you mentioned sort of it went backwards. I think, you know, we saw things like FTX, BlockFi, Celsius, you know, go under, and a lot of people had hard-earned dollars that thought they were in blockchain were in centralized institutions or centralized, products that they were using. And that really backfired. And, they went home for Thanksgiving and Christmas and told their families, hey, I lost, all this money using this blockchain thing. You guys should just be careful, don't use it, right? And so like that proliferated for a while. I think, even in some ways, I don't think we've actually fully recovered from a consumer standpoint on that, even though, from a price standpoint on Bitcoin, we've sort of exceeded that. I think right now what's super excited is now we've got, it took a long time, right? But now we've got this incredible foundation. We've got, I would say, fairly strong tooling. I think there's still huge opportunities in the tooling space. So tooling would be, how do you make it easier, faster, better for developers to build more effectively in this space? And I think sort of what's next is looking at, how do we actually go build those next sets of consumer apps that can actually go bring 5 million, 10 million, 50 million, 100 million people into the space without them knowing it, right? And I think that's the big part. I think we've, the industry's done a good job with getting people that are already, early adopters that are going to spend a lot of time, that are maybe are a bit more advanced with some of these things, but that's not going to cut it to go drive the next 100 million, 200 million people into this space. And so, in terms of identifying blockchain startups, I mean, we do look at, 300 to 500 startups. We partner with about 400 VCs and partners that share deal flow with us. And the big thing that we're, looking at, there's a few different things, but it's really about, early on when you're trying to really decipher what a or where a founder sort of stands, it's, what's the passion? Why are they solving the problem that they're solving? Why are they passionate about it? Why do we think that, or why do they think they're the ones to solve this? And those are going to be very, very important factors to start deciphering, like, what's real, what's not real. Are they in this for the right reasons? Are they not? Right? Because those are going to be very critical early questions in this space, especially where you just have such a massive volume of founders starting companies here. But it's not easy building a startup, and you've got to really put your blood, sweat, and tears into it to really build something incredible.
Yeah, I mean, I think you touched on like probably the biggest factor from my perspective, which is the difficulty of on-ramping into crypto, right? If you are not willing or not able maybe to put in the time, effort, and energy, it's quite difficult. Like even just setting up a, a wallet. Like I remember setting up MetaMask and, I would consider myself relatively intelligent and relatively capable, but it's not a simple process, right? And this, I think, for consumers became one of the big blockers. And it's interesting, you and I were talking just earlier, you've just launched Crypto Nights on Amazon Prime, which I think sounds like that may go some way to at least educating, if not resolving, that sort of problem. Do you want to talk a little bit about what your aim is with Crypto Nights, why you've launched that, what it is, and kind of who it's aimed at?
Yeah, absolutely. So Crypto Nights is a TV show that just launched on Amazon Prime Video. It's hosted by Adrien Grenier, which you might remember, Vinny Chase from Entourage, and Kim Lee from Bling Empire. And the big thing here is, how do we help, millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people learn about Web3 and actually decipher what's going on in a, an easy, fun way? And so it's a Shark Tank-like show. And we've got, a lot of heavy hitters from the Web3 space on the show. So including Brock Pierce, who's one of the founders of Tether. We've got Kyle Chassé, who leads Master Ventures, Magnus Krimlin from Antler, which runs a multi-billion-dollar portfolio there, and Nikita Sachdev, who runs, one of the top marketing and media agencies in the Web3 space. And so, phenomenal cast. And what's really interesting about how sort of the directors sort of produce the show is they've got sort of this boiler room in the Mac, right? And as the founders are pitching sort of in the main room, in the boiler room, they can actually explain sort of difficult concepts. So not only do you have certain KOLs there, or key opinion leaders, you have some of the other startup founders in there that are waiting to come into the crypt. And so what's actually really cool is, and we don't see this
I
as
love,
so
sorry, I just
Amex.
love the fact that it's called a crypt. That's yeah, that's pretty cool.
There you go. So as one of the knights, we don't actually see any of this even in the studio, right? Because it's all reality TV, right? So it's nothing, no statements are planned. And so, as we're talking to, or as the disruptor, we're talking to the disruptor or the founder, in the back, some of those concepts are getting explained. And then, they actually do a really good job of cutting that together to make it very simple to understand and break down Web3. So I think it's a phenomenal show to, both learn and have, a great time.
Yeah,
So something to check out.
yeah, no, for sure. I mean, it sounds like something I'd definitely be interested in watching. It sounds a little bit like, debate nights, in the US elections and so on, where you have the two main candidates debating and then you have the guys in the back room kind of spinning. So it's a bit like, I guess, I mean, crypto maybe has suffered from too much spin in the past, but it sounds like a more educational version of the spin room, which I think is super helpful. And exactly to your point, if they're explaining those key technological ideas, then I think as people are able to get under the hood and hear from people why it works rather than just like, trust us, it's fine, this is great, you'll make loads of money, or this will save you lots of whatever, depending on what the technology is. I think it just makes it hugely more accessible. One thing one thing I would like to understand, accountant to accountant, right, is for me, Web3, when I think about traditional finance and I think about DeFi, part of the problem is it doesn't grow, like it's really hard to kind of grasp how that would fit into traditional structures, right? And then you get the famous bank, Sam Bankman-Fried Excel spreadsheet with a bunch of money sitting on a, on the side on the balance sheet, supposedly, or whatever. How hard or how easy was it for you to kind of transition from that traditional accounting, debits, credits, double entry bookkeeping type of thought process into Web3? Because like that feels to me, for someone who kind of straddles a bit of both sides, I guess that feels to me like one of the problems is how do you get traditionalists like say myself more convinced?
Yeah, so keep in mind, right? So there's, I mean, there's a huge sort of almost like a parallel ecosystem that's happening, right? But keep in mind, stuff like FTX and Sam Bankman-Fried, I mean, this was centralized, right? So this is more similar to how you might think of like,
An
your
Enron.
centralized Robinhood
Yeah,
or
sure.
whatever,
Yeah.
right? Whereas from a decentralized side, you don't have that direct counterparty risk in the same way, right? There's other risks, right? You've got, cybersecurity risks, you're going to have smart contract risks, things like this. Now I think what's really exciting about decentralized finance, I think we're still early. I think there's still challenges, but like when I got into the space, keep in mind it had basically just been invented, right? So decentralized finance gets invented because something called automated market makers and liquidity pools get created, right? And that sort of changes the ecosystem. And so early on, like it was more just playing around with stuff and just interest, right? And I think over time, what's so exciting about it is we've really got an opportunity to, I think, solve a problem around 1 billion people that have a lack of identity and don't have access to traditional banking systems or hyper underbanked. And we're basically in decentralized finances, it's creating a parallel ecosystem where you've got borrowing, lending, and savings products, which I think are so critical. And our current system actually is failing on that, right? In various ways, right? I think it's failing because you've got a concept called de-risking or debanking that happens between, traditional banks in Western countries or developed countries, and then sort of emerging banks in emerging markets that, just they don't want to work with each other because of the lack of transparency,
Or
right?
even from them to consumers, right? Like, I mean, we have in the UK at the moment, neobanks debanking companies that are venture backed because they don't want to have that risk, right?
Yeah, I think that's a different risk, but I agree. Like, I think at least if you're in the UK, you probably have an opportunity to at least get to
Get
another
yeah
bank,
to get
right?
yeah to be banked by someone else, yeah, for sure.
And I think so. Debanking or like de-risking, it's sort of a concept where, and this is actually one of the biggest problems that oftentimes isn't talked about. It's say like you've got a major bank in New York, right? And they need to work with a bank in Kenya, right? But if the Kenyan bank can't tell them where the money is going to go after their customers touch it, so the next transaction, they won't work with them. But even if they're not sure if they trust them, they might just not work with them. And so now, like, every bank goes and cuts off those Kenyan banks. And now those Kenyan banks are kind of disconnected from the global system. And so this is actually a huge problem. This is part of the reason why you've got 1 billion people unbanked, right? Another part of that reason is you just don't end up with identities from some of those governments. There might be other mishaps, right? And so when you can literally create boring lending and savings products without needing to be part of any of that system, I think you have a huge, huge opportunity. And then you don't need to worry about things like, in some ways, you don't need to worry about as much of the risk that you might have seen in the global financial crisis. If you can sort of have the type of transparency because it's on chain, you can sort of demand it. Customers could sort of build towards making sure there's much more transparency in sort of where those assets are. And I think that's still a direction we're going. I don't think we're fully there. But I do think that decentralized finance sort of went under this aspect of being very easy to use to, I think, like early on, there wasn't a ton of different products, to being hyper complicated now, right? And I think we're going to go back and sort of as we leverage things like AI to use different parts of DeFi more effectively, and as sort of better and better sort of consumer-facing companies have that sort of leverage and use that, say, toolkit of decentralized finance in the background, I think we'll sort of get to a generation where it's actually going to be just as easy and just as fast to use as, say, like your traditional bank. But we're not fully there yet, I would say.
Yeah, no, look, I mean, I, but I think actually the fact that A, that we're not fully there, but B, that, you know, some of the hype cycle has died down actually allows people to kind of get down to building more thoughtful, more durable products, right, that are solving these sort of use cases. In fact, like, you know, you touched upon it in the sort of quickfire that we recorded earlier and again just now, but one of the sort of main impacts or opportunities it feels like for Web3 and blockchain is within emerging markets, right? And you've backed founders and startups like Credit, as you mentioned earlier, again in the quickfire, which you know, which is helping, I guess, get consumers banked in Africa and elsewhere. But what makes blockchain so uniquely valuable in these sort of regions, whether that's sub-Saharan Africa, whether that's LATAM? And is this where you see the foundations of a wider rollout of blockchain being built?
So I think there's a couple of aspects here, right? So when you go into emerging markets, and in some of these places, the people, the citizens, the population don't necessarily trust their national currencies. I mean, you've got high amounts of printing, you got devaluations of currencies, or at least highly fluctuating currencies, which make it very difficult, I think, for the everyday person to go manage, you know, their hard-earned dollars and actually make sure that they can go afford all the things they need to go afford, which might be food on their table, education of their kids, et cetera. And so what we're seeing now, which is, I think, fascinating over the last couple of years, is a huge, huge movement into stable coins that aren't their national currency yet, to basically preserve assets and erosion of assets. And so what we're seeing in a couple of ways is, one, you know, being able to access stable coins, so USDT, USDC in emerging markets has sort of become a growing trend. Being able to access Bitcoin has actually completely taken off as well. And that doesn't mean that's what you're going to use it for spending, right? And necessarily easily. Because if you're, you know, if you're in Nigeria, you can't easily spend US dollars typically, right? And I think that's changing a little bit. But you might actually hold, you know, your couple of months that you might have in savings or whatnot in US dollars, so it doesn't erode over that period, especially if the currency's fluctuating 5% a
Yeah.
month or
But
things
then
like
your
this,
problem
right?
is
Or 3%.
you have to go to the exchange guy on the street, and you're losing points off the exchange. And so there's another kind of form of erosion because the access is so hard anyway. Yeah.
And so if you were to do this traditionally without Web3, the challenge is going to be, exactly what you're saying, but I think also you've got just a black market oftentimes. So there's even a
Yeah.
big spread between those two. What's interesting, I think, right now with USDT or USDC is actually those rates are better than oftentimes that you're seeing out of those spreads are actually a lot tighter, which is good for the consumer. And it's actually very easy to go back and forth between them. So I think that's one thing we're seeing. And then we're seeing even remittances right now between the US and Africa sort of continue to pick up, especially because of some of the instability in, say, like Nigeria with the currency. And so you're actually seeing actually larger inflows of people even just sending money home. So there's the outflows, obviously, of people trying to get money out, but then there's people that are struggling that need to get money from friends, family in the United States or elsewhere. And so you're seeing that actually pick up a lot. So one great use case, of course, is the ability to get out of unstable currencies, right? And that historically, I'd say, has been extremely difficult for the average person, or even I'd say even closer to impossible for the average person, because if you don't have, tons of cash sort of sitting around or tons of capital sitting around, it's actually very difficult to go make that move or that trade and start holding assets abroad. And now actually you can do it instantly. And that I think is actually pretty game changing. And so you're seeing that. And what's interesting with this is actually gives people the power back to choose. And what that's going to force over time is governments are going to have to be more responsible, realistically, because if they're not, the collapses of currencies are going to be faster than ever because people have the ability to choose and leave that currency more and more and more.
But
And
do you think that's going to lead to, say, more sort of CBDCs, sort of central bank digital currencies, in an attempt to kind of stave off that problem? Or do you think that that's still too far away, or maybe even too big for them to implement and essentially, hold off that problem that they're likely to face in the future?
Yeah, my take on this is maybe different for most. I mean, essentially every country in the world will pretty much launch a CBDC, right? Because a CBDC is essentially a digitized version of your national currency. Now, those problems that we talked about devaluing currencies or depreciating currencies, like those problems are not because it's a problem because of a lack of controls, a lack of printing, a lack of governance, or like too much printing and a lack of governance. And so it's a problem that does get solved with the CBDC. It's the same, right? Whether you are digital or not digital, it's the same. In fact, if it's digital, it's probably worse, right? Because that means your cycles are faster,
Yeah, you can
like
create
your
much
velocity of
quicker.
money is faster.
100%.
So in reality, the fact that people can now choose easier than ever and move out easier than ever means that governments either need to be more responsible, right? And need to have better governance, need to have better controls, or they're going to get displaced quicker because people can choose and people can sell that currency essentially for something else. So I think this will be something that we'll see of currencies failing faster, even in some ways over the next, few decades, or strengthening because they actually realize that people have the ability to choose, whereas in the past they didn't. And currencies will strengthen as well.
The obvious use case there is El Salvador. So it's been a while now since they adopted kind of Bitcoin as a national currency. Like, how presumably you've been monitoring and kind of tracking what's happened there. How do you see that project? And I'm not sure project is even the right word, but how do you think that that's played out for them? Do you think it's been a net positive for them, or are there still challenges?
Yeah, so in El Salvador, I believe they use both the US dollar and Bitcoin. I think From what I've seen, a big part of the strategy from El Salvador is also just to hold and retain Bitcoin, which, has done well from them from like a appreciation perspective. I do understand that, people are using it as well, like in stores, et cetera. At the end of the day, I think Bitcoin is still not, I mean, it depends on sort of like your perspective, right? But Bitcoin is difficult to use as a pure currency
Yeah.
oftentimes. And I think the
It's a store of value
challenge.
rather than a currency. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, no, but I mean there is a benefit for the consumer maybe using it in some ways, because like say you're saving in it and your savings are theoretically going up if and historically Bitcoin's continued to go up, essentially, obviously there's been blips here and there, but it's been essentially up, over the course of its lifetime. So from a consumer perspective, it's good because your assets are essentially what you're spending on is going up. The challenge is like when you're running a business, you generally are trying to match the currency that you're receiving to the currency you're spending in as much as possible, right? Especially if you're sort of a local, smaller supplier, mom and pop shop, things like this, it tends to be you're trying to match that. So as soon as you sort of introduce Bitcoin, it gets very difficult because you're probably not paying your staff in Bitcoin. You're probably not buying your supplies in Bitcoin. And so, like, the system kind of breaks down as soon as you start to do that for your average person. Now, of course, if you have a larger, a bit more sophisticated operation, then you're going to start dealing with, okay, we need to do imports from X country. Now we're going to need US dollars, or we're going to need British pounds. And like, you can start to build a more complex, setup. But that's not so easy for the average person. So I think this is still a challenge when you start introducing any currency that's not your national currency, because
You
your
can't
labor
control it.
costs are going to, exactly. And then you got to start worrying about, okay, well, how do I go hedge this? Now, do I do derivative products? And like, so it does actually get pretty complicated pretty fast. And so these are, I think, some of the challenges around using Bitcoin. I think it's a little bit easier with like US dollars in some of these emerging markets, because over many years, it's sort of been moving towards, okay, well, US dollars is becoming more accepted, it's becoming more known, like if especially if your national currency has been eroding. So I look at it that way. I mean, I do think there's a benefit of using Bitcoin or USDT or USDC for payments from a consumer standpoint, but it is challenging.
No doubt. I mean, so one of the things that you and I had spoken when we first spoke, right, was kind of where the global hubs for Web3 are at the moment. Your fund's based in Singapore, but you've had some kind of recent experience in Dubai, UAE. So how would you contrast these as hubs, and what has made them so effective in embracing and driving blockchain innovation compared to, say, North America or certainly Europe? And on that note, like, what does the UAE get right about attracting blockchain talent and businesses that other regions might be able to learn from?
I think there's a couple of things here that have really helped, the UAE and Singapore to stand out. I think one is extremely clear regulation. I think the regulators have actually, been able to say like, here's the rules to play by. Here's sort of the, how we sort of look at this emerging technology. Here's how we look at exchanges. Here's how you go get licensed for things and, go at it. And I think that's actually very important. I think oftentimes regulators try to get too involved in these businesses, too involved in these companies, too involved in, creating too many different rules, right? You don't need 50 different licenses in a place and, super complicated rules. Like, essentially, to help foster innovation, you want to almost set, okay, well, here's the rules to play by. Here's how we're going to protect consumers. Maybe if you get above a certain size, there's going to be more rules, right? But you want them to be able to get to that size. Like, you don't want to put too many rules. At the end of the day, like, you want startups to go innovate, right? And go
So
test
almost
things.
like a
Like, of course.
sandbox, but broader, I guess, right?
Exactly. But I mean, even historically with sandboxes, I would say they've generally been negative because, and it depends on the country, but oftentimes what's happened in these sandboxes is you have someone that's pushing innovation. And so they're like, okay, a sandbox is a good idea. But then you've got a bunch of regulators that are, really about, okay, we're either protecting monopolies, or we're trying to protect other players, or we don't necessarily even want that innovation. So you get these sandboxes, and there's tons of stories like this where startups go to these sandboxes in their countries and they're like, hey, regulator, I want to do XYZ. And instead of the regulator saying, okay, you can go do that. Here's some parameters to operate within so you don't hurt any of like general consumers or whatnot. It's like, yeah, you're not allowed to do that. And so now instead of even being able to attempt it, it's just fully cut out. And this is a huge, huge problem, right? I mean, even take Ethereum, for example. Ethereum was invented in Canada, right? You would have had that technology stay in Canada and the main core team and the Ethereum Foundation, you know, essentially operate in Canada. You would have then had the entire invention of decentralized finance on large part in Canada, but you didn't have the right policies from a regulatory perspective to just get out of the way and let them operate and build something that's incredible for the world. And so they had to move, right? And so you then saw different individuals move because of concerns over regulatory aspects. And this is a huge problem, right? And so I think Singapore and the UAE have done a phenomenal job of one, setting those sort of rule sets and then letting people operate, which I think is very important. Two, I think what's been very impressive is the ability to bring talent. So especially in the UAE, and this isn't a Web3 thing, right? This is a general innovation thing.
Irrespective, yeah.
But what the UAE has been so impressive about is you want to come work here, operate here, bring your teams here, you can. Here's the rules, right? And it's very, very clear and very fast. And now think about it from the perspective of a founder and entrepreneur, right? You want to go build a business. You want, you know, maybe your CTO is in London, maybe you've got a team member in the US. And you're like, hey, let's all actually work together early on, especially early on in the foundation of business. Like being in person, working
Massive
together
important,
every day, ideating is very, very important. It's not impossible to do digitally, but I do think it's very critical to spend a lot of time together in person. And so now you've got a place where you can actually bring all of that talent to work and work together. And you're not violating any rules, you're not violating any visa requirements. Realistically, you can't do this in nearly any country in the world, right? You can't just
You
bring a
can't
bunch
do
of
that in
people.
the UK today, for sure. It's like it would be impossible.
And to me, this is actually like quite surprising, right? Because again, like at the end of the day, I think the government's job or the regulator's job is how do we go foster innovation and build the next best companies here so that we have more prosperity for our people, right? And a big part of that needs to all align of how do we go bring the smartest people here, right? How do we like all of these things should almost be like instant, like, okay, like we have technology now. We don't need months and months for paperwork to be mailed across the world or any of this stuff. Like we can do this in the span of hours, minutes, let's say days.
I mean, just to give you an example, and this is not even to do with getting a visa or a permit or whatever, right? I have the right to apply for Italian citizenship through my wife. I need to get police clearance certificates from every single country I've ever lived in. I have to get my birth certificate reprinted from Kenya and various other documents. And I have to get them all within the space of 6 months, have them notarized, have them translated and sent to the consulate all at the same time. And of course, pass a speaking exam. And I've known I've needed to do this for the last like 5, 6 years or whatever. Just getting it started is a headache because I know that once I trigger one, I'm under a massive, massive time constraint because if something fails, like if I can't get a police clearance from Papua New Guinea in time, which is highly possible because it's Papua New Guinea, like then my entire application falls over, right? And I think I mean I'm sort of talking in jest, but you can imagine throughout Europe you have similar regulations around all sorts of stuff. And I think one of the things that UAE and Singapore probably have done quite well, and correct me if I'm wrong, is not only have they been able to attract the talent by doing it, you know, seamlessly, digitally, and with as little friction as possible, but they've also been very good at bringing capital, or already had deep pools of capital, but certainly have been good at bringing external capital in. I mean, like you just have to pick up the newspapers today to read about, you know, how many millionaires have left the UK for Dubai. I'm not entirely sure I buy into that fully, but it is certainly happening to some extent, right? But they're able to attract both capital and talent, which is massively important for any startup.
Absolutely. I think at the end of the day, right, like you create this environment where people can thrive and then you sort of pour capital onto it, which you're seeing in some of these places. But and that sort of creates a recipe for being able to succeed. But keep in mind that capital is global. So even, wherever you are, like you don't need to be the UAE or Singapore to do this, right? Like you can create that foundation, that clarity, make it easy to come, and capital is global. Like even for us as venture capitalists, if we see an incredible company in a different country, like we will look at it. It's not, hey, you're not in the UAE, you're not in Singapore, you're not in the US, you're not in the UK, we're not going to invest in you, right? And so there's a lot of investors that are still going to invest in it if you find sort of a place that makes sense for you, you bring an incredible team and you're building an incredible startup. And so I think that's something that's really interesting, especially in this day and age, is capital is moving faster than ever. It's moving cross borders faster than ever. And so you can build from anywhere if you have that foundation. So this is actually an incredible opportunity for any country now to go take that model, go learn from the best, and create incredible infrastructure to then allow people to come, allow incredible things to be built. And it's easier than ever for people to move. It's easier than ever to move capital, right? So in reality, I would say to copy this formula is easier than ever. It's just more governments need to do it and follow it. And I think there's still a huge gap in the market where more and more people are looking for these types of things.
Well, I mean, to be honest, I think that the opportunity is really for a Western country to adopt this. Because if you look at where this is happening, it's happening in small nation states, right? Like UAE is small. You've got Dubai, you've got Abu Dhabi. Singapore is by definition like really small. Somewhere like Malta, where there is a huge crypto kind of base as well. It's a tiny little island in between Africa and Sicily. You know, to some extent, they've been able to do this because they do need people to come. They do need innovators. They do need to drive. Whereas the conversation in the West is like, how do we stop people coming in, right? So that's now in massive conflict. So how do you adopt a, we want to build up a startup nation, but hey, we've also got to make sure we're not letting, letting every Tom, Dick, and Harry into the country. And I think that's the real problem that they face.
On that point, I actually think we've got a pretty good example in the last 6 months, right? So you take what's happening in the United States. So regardless of what you think about the government or
We're
your
not
sort of
allowed to talk
political
about it on this
views,
podcast because we get shadow banned, but yeah.
fair enough. But regardless of what you think about the political landscape, I think what's been impressive from my standpoint on the venture side is I'd say 6, 7, 8 months ago, pretty much most founders we were talking about that were American or had ties to America were thinking about how do I operate outside of America in this industry, especially? How do I operate outside of America? How do I go build elsewhere? And how do I basically not serve Americans, block Americans from products and services? Like that has completely changed in the span of 6 months. I'm
Interesting.
actually very impressed with how much sentiment has changed to now. Nearly every American founder that I'm talking to is, how do I move back to America? All the action is in America. And how do we basically now operate and learn about sort of any of these changing rule sets in America? And so I think that's actually a very interesting thing because from a sentiment perspective, it's shifted a full 180. Now, I don't think regulation has kept up with sentiment though, right? Because a lot like the sentiment of the new the government or the administration is, let's say like pro business, pro startup, pro innovation. Having said that, like it takes time for these bills to pass in federal and state legislatures. And so there's still a long way to go on the bills, if to basically say put that innovation and that ability, kind of in stone and allow people to operate and have that infrastructure that we're talking about that sort of set up and clear in the UAE or Singapore. But I think it's actually moving in the right direction. And how fast it changes from a sentiment perspective is very important to note because that's a very short period to go 180. And that means other countries can really follow suit, right? And you see some of these problems in Europe on how difficult it is to do business. And again, like at least in my opinion, the job of the government is basically set clear rules and get out of the way and let people operate, right? And this is challenging in a lot of parts of Europe.
I mean, it's beyond challenging in Europe, if I'm honest. And I mean, I think it's interesting, the US debate, and again, to your point, putting politics and all the rest of it aside, I think sitting outside the US, it's very easy to get kind of captured by some of the negative sentiment, but even some of the boosterism. But I think, I actually was catching up with a family member who's based in San Francisco. I mean, he's happily building away and doing what he's always done. And if anything, I think he feels like San Francisco has specifically has possibly come full circle again. And there's a bit of negative sentiment maybe 3, 4 years ago, and that's kind of come back. But then you're now having these other hubs. Miami was a famous one just post-COVID, and then Austin now with Elon and various others. And so I can well imagine that, even feeling like there is a pro-business, pro-technology, techno-optimist kind of sentiment in government behind them, that is leading to more bullishness, if I can put it that way. Whereas obviously, as we know in Europe, there's the first question is how do we regulate, right? And how do we regulate hard? And obviously that becomes harder and harder. I mean, in fact, one of the, a good friend of mine who's building his teams here in the UK, one of the things he said to me is like, absolutely, I'm going to set up in the US. I think UK and Europe has massive opportunities in terms of talent, but from his perspective, he can get the capital in the US, and it's cheaper to build in the UK. In fact, I wonder whether the UK and maybe parts of Europe in the future are kind of turning into the India of 20 years ago, where the cheap labor and the outsourcing and the offshoring comes to the UK and countries like it in Western Europe. Because by regulating and by sort of dampening that kind of explosive optimism and growth of the startup ecosystem, they're actually doing themselves damage because wages are depressed here, salaries have been depressed, et cetera, et cetera. So now it for to your point, everyone can move anywhere. It has never been easier to set up a Delaware Topco or wherever else you may want to. Run your business, run your market out in the US, but have like a cheaper team sitting in the UK. And we got to figure out, in my opinion, we got to figure out how to get through that, through that mess, because I think that's the only way, or one of, it's not the only way, but it's one of the ways that we will hopefully be able to grow better into the future. And I think to your point, if we can embrace some of these ideas coming out of places like the UAE and Singapore and get smarter really about how we talk about this stuff and how we debate, how talent flows, it can only be a net positive.
For sure. I mean, I do think the UK is still has a very strong foundation, right? I mean, when you look at, the US is sort of, let's call it in a league of its own, right? In terms of, where to set up, where to operate, the capital, et cetera. But I would say the UK is probably number two, right? In a lot of ways.
If you put China to the side, I guess, yeah.
So China sort of operates in its own ecosystem. So
Yeah.
correct. But the UK from a setup capital perspective is still quite good, especially because there is pretty good rules around tax exemptions, rebates, things like this for like investors into early startups.
Yep.
I do think there's huge, huge opportunities to fix the regulation part. I mean, the regulation part at the end of the day basically helps to promote monopolies,
Yeah.
right? And that's a huge problem when you're thinking about innovation. And in a world that's, so interconnected, innovation wins, right? Because innovation can proliferate, a lot quicker. If you go back 100 years ago or pre-internet, like sure, the strategy around helping to keep your monopolies in power is fine to some extent. It's still not great, but like it can work. But in an age where innovation proliferates, it just means value and capital go outside of your country because you didn't innovate and someone else did.
Yeah.
And that's a huge, huge problem for countries. And I think you're already seeing that, but I don't think politicians have fully realized that.
Yeah. No, I think I'd agree. I'd agree with that quite wholeheartedly. I mean, moving on, we just talked about it a little bit, but raising and scaling today is, well, never been easier, but never been harder. It feels like it's there's a lot of tension between those two things. But given your experience mentoring, especially early stage startups in the space, what are you seeing as common challenges for blockchain founders, especially given what I would call kind of the fragmented and hard to communicate narrative that we talked about right at the top of the show that's hampered the industry for so long, especially around sort of this fund, you know, this question of how to fundraise and how to scale. And given how early you invest at Blockchain Founders Fund, how do you help your portfolio navigate from seed series A? And there's been some like incredibly interesting data come out of Carta recently showing, you know, seed to series A is down by 13, 14, 15% compared to a few years ago. And I think the metric, and I might get this wrong, but I think going some companies at series A are then taking 3 years plus to raise capital beyond then, right? So I'd love to understand kind of what advice you would have for founders and, you know, both given the difficulty of the narrative, but also the challenge of getting investors to commit to companies built in or focused on emerging economies, especially as well as the kind of tougher economic climate and macro situation we find ourselves in at the moment.
Yeah, so let me touch on first the challenge that you're talking about in terms of raising and where it comes from, right? Mm. So 3-4 years ago, what you saw was extremely high valuations on companies. Mm. And so this includes everything from like seed stage, series A, series B. And so what ended up happening is valuations ended up coming down and it actually hasn't fully recovered. So even those companies that sort of like series A that have gone and, you know, 3x their metrics, 5x their metrics, like because valuations have come down so much, they might not still be raising higher than they were or only just starting to raise higher than they were. So that's already a problem because generally on those priced rounds at series A, typically B, C, D is where you end up getting liquidity for early investors. So you're not getting liquidity for early investors. That's one thing, right? Yeah. The second part is you have a, because of that same problem, you have a lack of ability for companies to go public because they don't want to go public lower than the valuations that they had raised at a few years ago. And so that again creates a lack of liquidity to LPs and to early investors. And that's also a driving part of the problem. And that lack of capital to LPs, and then M&As are down, right? Of course. So M&As are down for the most part, and you're only starting to see it pick up a little bit right now, but that's also creating a problem of lack of liquidity. And so LPs then are not reinvesting capital because they don't have capital. It's becoming liquid.
Or right? Because they haven't seen any returns, venture. Right?
I mean, they haven't seen returns. Yeah. So the liquid returns from venture is not happening. Yeah. And so they're not redeploying it into venture.
Yeah.
So that's all been a challenge. Now, what that also means is VCs, a lot of them are drying up in capital because they've been investing for 3 or 4 years and haven't been raising, right? Because it's been a struggle even for the VCs to raise.
Yeah.
And so that's actually created, a huge, huge sort of trickle down across that entire ecosystem. Now, I think what you'll start to see soon is I do think we'll start to see companies start to go public again. I think there's already a lot of talks, even in our portfolio. There's more talks now about companies going public than pretty much ever before, right? Mm. So I think that's a good thing. I think we're starting to see more price rounds pick up right now, which is also a good thing because that's, again, going to create liquidity. It's going to create secondaries on price rounds, things like that. And then we're already seeing more M&As right now as well in the industry. So I think that's a big factor over the past, you know, month or so. We saw Bridge acquisition, $1.1 billion. We saw Deribit at $3 billion. By Coinbase. And so I think that's already starting to pick up and that's going to, again, trickle down, but it takes time. Mm. So those are some of the factors. I think in terms of raising for startups and some of the advice that we give our founders, is there's basically two tracks, okay? So there's your company, your product, your traction to date. That's one track. Of course, you're trying to maximize that. But when you're fundraising, it's kind of not related, right? Because like your traction is your traction, your progress is your progress. When you're fundraising, like
it's
you're not
story.
Changing this part, right? Yeah. Like you've essentially maximized to where you can at any point in time, right? Mm. So then now you've got this fundraising track. So keep in mind, completely separate. So it's not related in a lot of ways to this other track. And so what we tell our founders is, it's okay if an investor doesn't invest in your business, but it's not okay if they don't invest for the right reasons, right? And so what that means is, If an investor doesn't invest because they don't buy into your thesis, they don't buy into your vision, that's okay. Now, if they don't buy in because you didn't have an extremely tight process, you didn't have a very clear pitch, you didn't have, very clear talking points, you didn't have very organized data room or like things like this, like that's a problem.
Yeah,
Because
that's admin. Like surely.
it's admin and it's just putting in the work,
Yeah,
right? And
yeah.
so if I break it down, right, and I'll be very specific on tips that you can use, right? If I break it down, so first you start off, and we've got a 90-step process, by the way, as we go through this with founders. So it's like very, very clear, and it's how do we basically go take our companies and be the best in the world at all these other things
Is that
so that you
open
have you
source?
put your best foot forward.
Can I get my hands on that 90-step process?
So it's not something we share publicly typically. I mean, I'm happy to share it with you, but it's not something we typically share publicly,
Yeah.
right? But I can give you the sort of key parts of it right now, right?
Sure.
So the first part is the pitch deck, right? Now, what I would suggest on the pitch deck is DocSend literally puts out a report every single year that covers what slides are in successful pitch decks, what order they're in, what's the percentage likelihood, and how many slides. So go copy that. Don't go reinvent the wheel. Go copy that, right? They've literally got up-to-date data every year on what sort of is in successful decks. So that's one, a really good stat. Two, take that pitch deck as you iterate on it and put it into pitchleague.ai. Now you'll get a real-time AI score and feedback on your deck and how to improve it. And it's actually really good. So we get all of our companies to go do this. Then, of course, you can go to some friends or family or things like that, ask them for feedback. But I would do those other steps first,
Yep.
right? Now, at that point, you'll already have a pretty clear pitch deck. The next thing is then you're going to basically start setting up investor and advisor updates. And so the way we look at this is before you start fundraising, and so this might even be before the pitch deck step, is you want to start to update investors, advisors, and potential investors. And so you want to actually build a pipeline and you want to consistently do this. I used to send updates to my investors, advisors, and potential investors every single Sunday. So every Sunday I would send it. It'd take me about 40 minutes every Sunday night. That might be a little bit extreme, but at least doing it every month, that's sort of the very least,
Yeah.
right? And the idea behind this is when you're not fundraising and you're sending updates to investors, advisors, potential investors, it becomes a lot easier to have all of these different data points to then assess a company, right? So if a company tells me, hey, we're going to hit $1 million in revenue in December of this year, okay? It's very difficult for me to assess the likelihood of that based on just that statement. But now, if in January they say, hey, I'm going to hit, 5,000 by February. And then in February I see, hey, they hit 5,000. And then they say they're going to hit 12,000 in March. Like I now start to see data points. Now, when that same person tells me they're going to hit $1 million in December, it becomes a lot more likely that I can, one, trust them, but two, extrapolate data points. And so that is very, very important. So basically, when you're not fundraising, send updates. When you're fundraising, still send them. But that's going to help investors to understand and see those data points, see the progress, and it becomes a lot easier to invest in. So that's sort of the next part. Then the part after that is making sure that you've got very, very clear talking points. So we tell our founders to have 11, 30, and 90-second pitches, right? So 11 seconds is going to be, your hook and your key statement on basically like why this is basically something I should listen to, right? And that's going to be why you're building what you're building and sort of like excitement around it. Your 30 and 90 second are basically going to be breakdowns then of including that same first 11 seconds, right? Because everything's modular. So that same first 11 seconds that I'm listening. And then it's going to be why do you have, the best, or why does this problem need to be solved? Why is it you have the best solution? Why now? Why do you have the best team in the world to go do this? What traction you're having, and then maybe like how much you're raising as an example, right? But basically having one sentence on each of those things is all modular. So now imagine you're in a conversation with an investor and say it's even a 20-minute pitch. What's going to happen is you're going to be going through that pitch deck typically, depending on your style, but typically you're going to be going through that pitch deck and you're going to get to your team slide. You're going to say that one sentence hook slide on your team and then you're going to elaborate on it. But you've now got a very concise, very clear statement on your team, and then you're going to get your solution and your product and all of these different slides, and you're going to have that one key hook sentence already down. And it's the same sentence as you're going to use in person or in that 90 seconds, but it makes it very easy because it's modular, right? But that's going to help to tie together the whole thing. And so we find that to be very valuable. And then after a call, we recommend our founders to basically send out a data room. Obviously, that assuming that's your sort of action item at the end of the call,
Sure.
but send out your data room within 10 minutes of that call. So we actually are very clear with our founders. We want this to be quick. We want them, like, while the investor's thinking about it, you want to send them the information. You want to look organized. You want to have it. And it's all very easy because if you have it set up in advance, you're emailed out to that investor, your message out to that investor is, hey, great chatting. Here's one thing we talked about that's going to be sort of custom. And then here's the action items we talked about. Here's the data room. Here's my calendar, schedule another call. Happy to connect on, Friday again or whatever,
Sure.
right? And so that becomes very clear, but the investor's already going to be impressed about it. They're already going to be thinking about it. They're already going to set their next action item, which might be to, send it to their analyst for review if it's a VC or
Well,
whatever they have to do
they also
internally.
don't have to come back to it cold, right? Like they're already in, they've just spoken about it. They've got the data. They don't have to refer back to notes, in a week's
Of
time, et
course.
cetera, et cetera. Yeah.
And so it's so important. And I think that also builds a lot of trust with the investor that, hey, you're differentiating yourself. Because the amount of founders I'd say that like send me something a week later, number of days later, I think is like, it's a very big difference, right? And then in that data room, I'd say just be hyper organized. We recommend five folders, to have in there and just have it very clear. But you can look up best practice on data rooms in an hour, probably. You could have it at a world-class level or 2 hours if you just look at what are the best practices and how to copy it, right? And so these are not hard things to do. You just got to put in the work and spend a little bit of time, maybe look at a few examples online as some people that are the best at it, and go copy it. Then you have a very good baseline. And so I think these are important. Oftentimes founders skip these things, but just keep in mind it's a separate track. Like fundraising, you're selling equity. It's a sales exercise in the same way you're selling your product, but these are two different tracks essentially. And so you can, put your best foot forward by nailing this track around fundraising, and that's going to help you, of course, on the other side to get the capital that you need.
So this is super interesting to me, right? So obviously, as CFOs, as you know, we kind of, support early stage venture-backed startups. And obviously, during the fundraise process, it is often the CFO that is responsible for putting together data room, making sure that, all of those admin sort of bits are really nailed. And I would say we've got that process that, I mean, like everything you talked about just there is pretty much what I would say to a founder as well. Although I didn't have the 11:30 and the 90-second pitches. I did have the 1 minute pitch, which is like run, like if you can't run through your deck in 1 minute and get your point across, then maybe you need to revise your deck or your actual pitch. But what I wanted to ask is, from your perspective, do you think a lot of fundraisers or pitches fail because of that admin? Because I get your point, right? If they don't invest because of your thesis or because they don't buy into what problem you're solving or whatever, that's that's a thesis issue, right? That's like the investors made a decision based on their knowledge of the market and the ecosystem, et cetera. But I can understand why they might not invest if the process is run a bit shoddily, but do you think that that is a large failure point? Like, is that a significant point of failure for a lot of founders trying to fundraise, or is it, is it more a case of getting it right from the start will just make it simply easier? But if you don't get it right, you're gonna hamper rather than kill your fundraise.
No, I 100% think it kills fundraisers. I mean,
Okay.
like you look at the amount of founders right now that spend all year fundraising, right? And then the problem is you're not focusing on your business. Your
Yeah.
metrics are not going to be as good if you're spending all your fundraising, because now 30%, 40%, 50% of your whole year is fundraising. Whereas if you have a very tight process, you get it done in 8 weeks, 12 weeks, and like it still takes time, right? But 8 weeks, 12 weeks, you get it done, you get the money in, you then go back to focusing on product, you make sure you hit your metrics, and you come back out and you go fundraise, right? And that's going to work a lot more effectively. But if you don't have a tight process, you're losing investors for the wrong reason. Like And keep in mind, investors aren't just looking at one company. Like, we're looking at 300 companies, 400 companies,
Exactly.
500 companies a
Yeah.
month, right? We're going to see another company that's exciting, that's organized, that sends us the information we ask for,
Potentially in the same space as well, right? Yeah.
right? And then, maybe that's what we invest in, right? But it's like, also keep in mind, a big part of it is, how do you like differentiate? Like, you're trying to create a feeling as well for an investor, right? And you're differentiating if you're very organized, and it's a very clear reflection on your business, right? Like, if you're very organized on this track and you're creating and instilling confidence in the investor because you have your pitch down, you know what you're talking about, you've got a very clear data room, you're following up within 10 minutes after that call, like, that's going to instill a bunch of confidence. That's also, that confidence translates into how much confidence I put onto you executing on your product side
It's all signals,
and with
right?
your customers. And so it's signaling. And so I do think it's actually very, very important. I think oftentimes founders just skip or don't know. And I
I
think you
think,
really just got to look at best practices.
yeah, I think for a lot of founders, what it comes down to is, I mean, they have such an inherent and to some extent, possibly even overly optimistic belief in their product and in their business. And it is very much a case of build it and they will come, or send my deck and they will invest. But obviously, to your point, investing, and I think this is one of the things that founders often, certainly at the earlier stages, probably understand less, which is investing is a job, it may be a passion, but it is still a job, right? And the job of a VC, or certainly for an institutional investor, is to invest in businesses, teams, products that are going to be able to create returns for their fund and for their LP. Okay, an angel investor may take a slightly different angle, but even for them, they are still looking for returns for themselves. I mean, obviously, the reason we do the things that we do as CFOs is to help that make sure that that financial narrative is in place, such that if I'm coming to you with a founder who's pitching his business, he is going to tell you how Blockchain Founders Fund is going to make money out of this, right? Because otherwise, what's the point, right? And I think there is this sort of disconnect between the understanding of what an investor is and does versus, what founders would like for them to do, because I think there is this sort of almost naivete around, well, they fund innovation, and if our business is innovative enough and looks interesting enough, then I can get away with all the rest of it.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think it's a misconception, right? And I think another sort of misconception is, like, DEX do not raise money,
No,
right? I
100%.
think people think DEX raise money. They don't, right?
They're a
Like,
foot in the
the
door.
only job, yeah, exactly. The only job for a DEX is to get you on a call, right? Ideally, you're getting on a call, and then the DEX is kind of irrelevant then in some ways. Like, sure, you might use it on the call, but now it's you,
It's a
right? It's
prop.
not the DEX.
It's a prop. It,
And
like, to your point, fundraising is a sales process, right? So I always say, to founders, the purpose of your deck is to get your foot in the door, and then that is where you pitch the business, whether or not you use the deck. And often you may have a demo, or you may have something else that you use to pitch the business, but the deck is literally, can you get enough interest from the investor that they want to, as you say, pick up your Calendly link and book in a call? And I think, and this is the other thing that I say to founders all the time, right? And I see it like a lot, is kind of where founders put in everything into the deck. So you get like a 50 page, sort of 50 slide deck. And I'm like, look, A, no investor is going to look at this for more than a minute and a half. You want to make sure that everything is in those first four slides, six slides, concise, not thousands of, like, here's how we made, headlines in the Daily Mail and wherever else, but like, this is what we've done. This is how we're doing it. This is the team. This is why we're going to win. Like, these are the important things. Everything you do to obfuscate that with like random quotes and, here's a 3 pages worth of advisors actually detracts from your deck. It doesn't add to it.
Well, so I'd say two things. So one, it detracts from your deck, but two, it signals to me that you can't communicate with your customers either, because you're going to do the same thing, and you can't. And so, like, it's actually shows that you've got a problem even from a sales perspective.
Mm.
And so actually I usually look at it as a red flag for multiple reasons.
Yeah, I look, I completely get it. And again, we could talk about this for probably quite some time. But look, as we're kind of getting to the end of the show, I have a couple of just last minute questions for you. So I'd love to understand what is one thing that you have a contrarian conviction about from any area of life, whether that's work, politics, socially, or at home. Feel free not to answer, by the way, which is often the response that we get back.
I mean, I think that, that's a good question. It's a very good question. I mean, I've got a probably a contrarian view, and you probably saw a little bit of it, but you know, in trust on government, and I think what that means is that you know there can be great governments, but you know it's really about getting out of the way. It's setting up that foundation and getting out of the way. And I think what we're going to see in this generation or in this sort of next little bit with Web3 is you're going to see companies that allow, you know, full, like a full set of like rights, free speech. I think we're seeing that sort of get caught up in and sort of deteriorated in a lot of different countries right now. And I think with Web3 and with ZK and the privacy, essentially, I think we're going to actually start to see a huge shift back towards free speech. I think we're going to see like parallel universes in some ways around like creating decentralized ad networks that can't be shut down. I think we're going to start seeing like decentralized like social media really take off, and you know people being able to not say like delete or reverse a lot of you know what essentially is going to be history. But I think we're going to start having big movements towards, you know, free speech and across the
But
world
I
right
mean, but
now.
this was the whole kind of point of decentralized networks and teams is it, like essentially Web3 was almost an answer to fill the governance gap that governments had caused through overregulation, right? Like, and this is why obviously at one point I think. Jack Dorsey wanted to make Twitter, decentralized specifically to assist with this. And look, execution up until now doesn't seem to have come through. But yeah, I understand the premise. I think it's filling that gap that governments just seem unable to, unable to solve for themselves.
Yeah, I mean, I would say actually it's come a long way in the last couple of years, or at least a year, right? I mean, X has sort of gone to the point where I'd say it's become much more open and free. I'd say like Facebook has even changed their policies around what they were
Yeah.
censoring and not censoring.
Well, they got
Now,
rid
there's
of
of course like
their kind of whatever the team was, I can't remember, but yeah.
So I think the sentiment and the pendulum is shifting, and I think it's going to go more and more, especially when you look at sort of what's happened around the world, everything from COVID to the truckers in Canada to all sorts of other things that I think have been like a huge challenge against like freedoms. And I think we're going to have a big shift in a way where then like governments are going to essentially lose power around this, right? Because it's going to basically be decentralized.
Yeah. No, I think that's super interesting. And we shall see. I think, yeah, look, I think it's always an interesting question, right? And we're seeing it in terms of how people in general are voting these days, right? Like there is a very big pushback across across the globe on sitting governments, on traditional kind of two-party networks, et cetera, et cetera. And I think all of this has arisen out of this kind of malaise that has settled into certainly Western governments, and people want more autonomy and more, ability to do what they think is right. So finally, so that our audience can get to know the real you, if there is indeed one real you. What is something that moves you most emotionally?
Yeah, I mean, something. I mean, I'm very, very family oriented, right? So, you know, I think that Like I love spending time with family. I think in general, I'm probably a somewhat I get moved a lot by my emotions. You can probably see part of that on Crypto Nights, where I'm just very passionate or sometimes, it just depends how I'm feeling, right? But you'll see part of that on the show as well. But a big part for me is just family obviously comes first, and health and these things are super important to focus on, right? And if you don't have those right, then I think it's very difficult to go get the rest of life and business correct, because it's essentially a shaky foundation.
You're a very good Gujarati boy, clearly. Parents must be very proud. Listen, Ali, it's been absolutely incredible having you on the podcast. Thank you so much for joining me. For the audience, where's the best place for them to find you online? Are you on LinkedIn, Twitter? Where can they find you on the internet?
Yeah, so I mean, you can find me at on blockchain.ff on our website. If you have an idea, you can share it with us. You can find me on LinkedIn, Ali Madhavji, on X, Ali underscore Madhavji. So definitely feel free to reach out if you're working on something very cool, and happy to see if it's something we can help with.
Amazing. Well, look, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. It's been an absolute blast having you on the podcast.
My pleasure.